Hi everyone, welcome to Guida Galattica per Fisiotherapisti podcast. Today I'm really happy and honored to welcome with us Professor Peter O'Sullivan. Hi Peter, how are you doing?
Hi, nice to meet you. Hi to all your listeners.
Yeah, thanks again, Peter, for accepting our invitation and being with us today. Obviously, we've got loads of questions for you. As always, we will follow our format. I know you don't need no introduction, but if you can start as we normally do, talking about a bit your background and your professional experience and your current roles.
Okay, so I grew up in New Zealand, and I went to school there, and I did my basic physiotherapy training there. And then after 4 years, I decided I need to get further education. And I came to Western Australia to do was a diploma of manipulative therapy, so manual therapy training. When I finished that, I then worked in clinical practice, both in a private practice as well as a pain clinic, and decided pretty quickly that my manual therapy skills worked for one group of patients and didn't work for another group. So I needed a different way of looking at the problem that I was dealing with, people's pain. And so I started to do enrolled in a Master of Science to do research, and then transferred that to a PhD. So I finished my PhD in my late 90s. And then since that time, I have worked half-time as an academic. So predominantly doing research, but also teaching, and also working as a clinician, predominantly seeing people with persistent and disabling musculoskeletal disorders. So we know that back pain is like one of the leading causes of disability in the world. So I see quite a lot of back pain, but I see people with neck pain, shoulder pain, hand pain, foot pain, knee pain, hip pain, tendon pain, you name it, pain, TMJ, anything that is disabling or distressing to a human being is sort of the kind of thing that I would see.
Ah, oh, perfect. Yeah. And then my first question is about this double role of clinician and researcher. Yeah. And my question is, how do you manage the two, first of all, but also what would you advise to clinicians who are willing to be more involved in the research or academic world in general?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think what often you see is that you see clinicians sitting here and researchers sitting here, and the clinicians say, you guys are doing a bad job, and the clinicians say, you don't understand our world. So I've been very lucky to sit like this. That is, I have two hats. I have a clinician's hat. I've been trained as one. I train clinicians. I work as one. And then I do research into essentially testing the belief systems that I've been taught as a clinician. So it's a perfect situation, really, because the clinic, in a sense, becomes like a testing lab. I kind of see it like, if you're going to design a really good car, do you ever test drive it before you do research on it? You probably would. So in a sense, the clinical work becomes a lab for me to road test things, and then the lab becomes an environment where you can test your hypotheses. So I might, within the clinic, see something or observe something and have an idea of something, or I might have gone, there's this common belief, for example, that posture is a cause of back pain. Why don't we do a project to look at that? There might be a common belief that core muscles are really important for the back. Why don't we do an EMG study to look at that? There's a research project to core beliefs that, you know, you've got to keep a straight back when you lift. So why don't we look at that? So, so all of our research projects essentially are driven out of the clinic, questions that are developed at the clinic. Then we go back to the lab and we test them. And then we find something that we didn't believe, which completely contradicts the things that we did believe. And so we've got to update what we do in the clinic. So there's this kind of back and forth process where you have an idea, you test it, you realize it wasn't what you thought, you go back to the clinic, you reinterpret it, you update your knowledge, you shift your practice. And so it's a constant process of growing and learning and being challenged, I think, as well. Yeah. So if I look at what I believed as a clinician 20, 30 years ago, it's completely turned on its head to what I now understand and believe, just because of the work. It's not just our group, but our research as well as other people's research has forced me to shift how I work as a clinician or how I think as a clinician. And that's a wonderful thing. It's hard. It's hard to do two things well, but it's probably been, I kind of feel like the people who question me the most are my colleagues or my patients. And so I probably have learned the most from patients who I have failed, who have come back to me and said, "You've made me worse. You know, it didn't work." And then I've gone, "Why? Why?" So the why question underpins both my clinical practice and my research.
Yeah, but it's great to ask that question, because otherwise you stick to what you know and you never change.
That's hell boring. I mean, if that was my job, I wouldn't be doing this job.
Yeah,
it's definitely. Like, you know, the lovely thing about clinical practice is that every day I work with patients, I learn something. Every day I work in the university system, I learn something. So it's this constant process of learning and being challenged, which is the wonderful part, because, you know, like, no one's got all the answers to these really complex problems. So this problem will outlive me.
Yeah, absolutely. And then now I just want to move a little bit more into our topics of, yeah, physiotherapy, rehabilitation. And obviously the first question that came to my mind was about the biopsychosocial model approach. And the questions are, so how do you effectively realize it in your daily practice, but also what are the limitations of just using a biological model?
Yeah, so look, biology is central to pain. And I think the biggest mistake is where you start separating psychosocial and bio. So your emotions drive your biology, your thoughts drive your biology, your expectations drive your biology, your sleep drives your biology, your levels of exercise drive your biology. Whether you've damaged tissue or not influences your biology. Whether you've got pathology drives biology. It is all biology. It's just influenced by different factors. So the idea that you separate them is completely weird in my mind. Even though historically I was taught in segments, you know, it's like, this is nociceptive pain. It's all about structure. Well, it's never all about structure. If you sprained your ankle, yeah, it's about structure, but it's also about your perception around the environment, the social environment, your beliefs about what happens when you sprain your ankle, whether you want to play football or not, or whether you're in a work site that's a dangerous place for a sprained ankle. It's going to completely change your behavior and the way you respond to that sprained ankle. If you've got a parent who sprained an ankle and ended up on workers' comp and have surgery, you're going to have a completely different response than if you had a parent who sprained an ankle, who ignored it, carried on, and got better within 2 weeks. So it's, even if you have bio, it is massively influenced by social and psychological factors.
Yeah, absolutely. But then one of the things that we hear a lot from some practitioners when we talk about, for example, the psychological aspect is, yeah, okay, yeah, but I'm a physiotherapist, I'm not a psychologist, and I don't feel comfortable dealing with this. So how do you normally respond to these arguments?
Yeah, I think it's understandable, because a lot of physiotherapist training hasn't trained physios to deal with it. So it makes complete sense they don't feel equipped, because it's like saying, bringing in a car and it's blowing smoke and you've never looked under a bonnet. How would you know how to understand what the smoke means? Like, unless you've been trained to deal with it, of course you won't feel confident to deal with it. And that's a huge gap in our training, is we've not done well about educating and upskilling physiotherapists to deal with human distress. And I think it's really important to separate mental health problems from psychological problems. So any human being who develops pain and they don't understand what's going on and they lose control or that stops them from doing stuff, it will cause distress. It's normal. That's just normal. So we've got to stop pathologizing psychosocial factors and normalize them because it's normal. And if you want to deal with people with pain, you are dealing with psychological factors and social factors, because the pain, if it's disrupting them or distressing them, will influence their family environment, their work environment, their social environment. So you just can't separate it. But so there are two issues around that. One is not stigmatizing it and just understanding that it's normal, but also to understand that we need to screen for patients who've got comorbid mental health problems, because we know that the number of people in our society who suffer from depression or anxiety is about 30%. That means 1 in 3 people are already suffering from that. And we know that people in pain are a bigger number even then. So there's the evidence in primary care of people coming to you for back pain, acute back pain, would suggest that about 70% or 75% of those people will have some level of emotional or social distress linked to their pain. Now, if you don't want to deal with that, you shouldn't be treating people with pain. You should go and do something else.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't tolerate this idea that I'm not a psychologist. Yeah, of course I'm not a psychologist. I don't treat people who've got panic disorder about something else. I work with people who are depressed and anxious all the time. That's a normal part of my day. But if the depression and anxiety predated the injury or it's dominating the presentation, then I work in conjunction with a psychologist.
Yeah, of course. And then now what we also like to do in our podcast is to try to be a little bit more practical, to talk about like a potential scenario where you have, for example, a patient walking through your door and he's complaining of an ongoing non-specific low back pain. So in terms of like your subjective assessment, what are the information that you want to have from this patient on day one, on your first appointment?
So the most important thing is I want to put my shoes in your shoes. So if you're the patient who's come to see me and you said, look, you know, I'd say hello to you first. I'd say, tell me your story. That's my first question. Tell me your story. Everyone has a story. And if you ask an open question like that, they'll start their story anywhere. So I saw a lady yesterday, for example, who I said, she's 57. She came in to see me and I said, tell me your story. And she said, I was diagnosed with a scoliosis when I was 14. That was the beginning of her story. It's like, well, if I'd said, what can I do for you today? She said, I've got a back problem. But she started her story when she was 14. She said, then I had Harrington rods put in my back. And I was told I'd have to be careful with my back because in later life I could have trouble. And now I'm having trouble. That's her story. So that's so important for me because I need to then understand that this lady's got a long history. At the very early age, she had the seed planted in her mind that she could get in trouble with this problem. And so then I went through a process of saying, so can you tell me about when your pain started? It only started 12 months ago. So she'd lived for years with this thing. Harrington rods, fused back, scoliosis, never been a problem. Then the last year, I said, so what's changed in the last year? Well, what do you think's going on? She goes, oh, I think I'm just getting old. And this is just now a process of getting old. I'm going, okay, so what do you think changed a year ago? Did you just get really old a year ago? Or is that a tipping point of getting old? Is that like the, you know, 56 is good, but 57, it's downhill thereafter? She goes, yeah, I think that's what it is. And I've been to see the doctor and he said, I've got degenerative changes in my back. You know, it's so I've got arthritis. So I'm 57 and now I've got arthritis. And she goes, the thing that really frustrates me is I love to be active. And now I'm frightened to be active. So I love mountain hiking in the hills and carrying back. It hurts me to do that. So I'm fearful of doing that. And now it's stopping me from cooking and I have these episodes of pain. I have to lie down. So it's actually limiting my ability to live. So within 5 minutes, I've heard her beliefs, her healthcare interactions, her impairments, her distress, her worries. And I go, what do you see your future? She goes, I fear I could end up in a wheelchair. I'm like, 5 minutes, I've got all that information. Now, if you understand what drives pain-related disability, that doesn't get better. So she developed pain, it hasn't got better. And in fact, she feels like it's getting worse. Well, what do we know about that process? We know that when you have negative beliefs, when you become emotionally distressed and overprotective of your body, and you start guarding and avoiding things that you value, you set up a cycle. That's her story. And I got that in 5 minutes. Now, she came into my room. I said, oh, hi, what can I do for you today? She would have gone, oh, I've got this back problem. And I don't know, you know, I've got, da, da, da. It would have taken me down a different path. You know, the usual tick list that we ask people, I don't ask people, but historically physios ask, where's your pain? What aggravates it? What eases it? What's it like at night? What's it like in the morning? You know, all the stuff that we've been told to do, which doesn't really tell us very much about the person's experience. And then what are you going to do?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's definitely, definitely a much better question when you ask. And then
so I ask that question with every person I see, everyone.
Perfect. And then the other common thing is that very often then patients are very keen for you to see their scans, and maybe they've had multiple scans over the years.
Right, let's look at them.
And then most of the time they also believe that what the scan, what they found on the scan is the actual reason of their pain. And so how do you then manage their expectations, and how do you explain the scan findings to them?
Yeah, so I'm working with, this lady's a good example, because she brought in a scan and she's been told she's got arthritis. So it's like, okay, let's look at your scan. It's like, okay. This is what, do you know what it looks like? No one knows. Most people don't have no clue what their bodies look like. They've just read this scary report. So it's like, oh yeah, there's a vertebral body. Here's your disc. There's your facet joints. This is what it looks like. They don't know. They could be looking at, you know, some strange painting. They wouldn't have a clue. So it's really important that you pay attention to the things that your patients are concerned about. And then before I would make a judgment on the scan, I'd say, now having looked at your scan, I want to examine you. Because what was interesting in this lady when I saw yesterday, she said, the things that give me relief are when I relax. So if I sit for a period of time, my back seizes up, tenses up. It's like seizes up. I'm going, oh, do you feel relaxed? She goes, relax. No, I never relax. I go, is that just you or is that just recently? Well, I'm not a very relaxed person, but no, my back feels tense all the time. I said, why do you think it's tense? She's going, I don't know. But I said, do you feel like you're a tense person? Have you had more tension in the last year? And she goes, actually, you know what? I've had a lot of stress in my last year. A lot of stress. Do you think stress affects your pain? Yeah, I've noticed that these episodes are around a time that I'm stressed. So what relieves your pain? It's relieving when I relax. So are you telling me then that stress and tension's driving your pain? Yeah, I think I am. So let's examine that. So then the examination becomes an exploration of what the person's told me as their lived experience. So tell me the things that provoke you. Bending provokes me, standing provokes me, loading provokes me. Let's look at what you're doing when you're doing that. So then the examination looks at that. So at the end of the session, I have her relaxing and moving, and her pain reduces dramatically. And I said, so what do you think about your diagnosis of arthritis? And she goes, I think it's rubbish. She goes, because you've shown me that if I relax and move, I feel better. And if I had arthritis, well, you know, if my back was damaged, probably would make it worse. I go, well, actually, backs love, for the health of your back, they love to move. They love to be relaxed. But it sounds to me like when you're tense and clenching those muscles, that's when you have your pain. Interestingly, where I push on those tender points of your back is not your spine or your joints, it's your muscles, and they're very tense. So in a process of listening to the person, acknowledging their worries, looking at their spine, their scan, examining them, bringing the question back to them as to how they make sense of it. And they might say, what do you think? I said, well, look, any, and I, she asked me this, what do you think? And I said, well, look, anyone of your age and my age will have stuff on a scan. It's normal. It's like saying, you know, I've got some gray hair. I've got some wrinkles on my skin. This is normal stuff. The good thing about your scan is like, you know, you're, these are normal findings of people of your age. There's nothing abnormal in this. There's nothing that's telling me you've got compressed nerves or broken joint, you know, broken bones, damaged discs. So, and your story isn't one of damage. You never had an injury. You just developed stress. And she's going, and I said, does that make sense? So she goes, it makes complete sense to me. I couldn't work out why my pain was random. Couldn't work out why I was active one day and it would hurt and the next day it wouldn't. I just didn't understand it. This makes sense. So we kind of look at this process of what we call sense making to take this person's story and create a picture that relates to their story. Because there's nothing worse than saying to someone, look, your spine's fine. And they're like going, it doesn't feel fine. It feels damaged. You're telling me it's fine. And then you create an argument. That's horrible because the person doesn't feel listened to or validated.
Yeah. So then it's the patient that is obviously realizing practically by doing things.
Your story. So you tell me, and I'm a big believer on the person will bring, they are the key. It's not me. I'm doing less work than them.
Yeah. Just giving the tools to realize that.
Yeah. And that's a really nice way to work because it takes a lot of pressure off me as a clinician as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And then the next question is about, obviously, if we look at the evidence-based practice as obviously the best external evidence that we have, and obviously the clinician expertise, but also patients' values, then sometimes we can have patients with very strong opinion, or obviously they've been treated, been told things over the years. And obviously, maybe you have a different opinion, or you have your professional opinion. So how do you normally deal with this situation where maybe there's this big gap between the patient's expectation and opinion and your professional view?
So the time that normally happens is if there's someone they've seen, like you talked about earlier, they've seen the doctor and the doctor says, you've got a damaged back. You shouldn't walk, you shouldn't exercise. You can't go back to work with this. You probably need surgery. So then the person comes in and the first thing I'd say is, how do you feel about that? And I'm like going, oh, I feel terrible about it. Like, you know, this is so distressing for me because I don't believe I'll ever about to change. So is that how you feel deep inside, or is that what you've been told? Is that really your belief, or is that just stuff you've been told? Like, how strong is that belief in your mind? And then for what do you think? If you're thinking you're damaged, what do you think I can do? Like, what's my job? Well, you might better, you know, stabilize those damaged structures. So you want some support or some strategies to deal with that. Or they go, you know, I just want to rub down. It's okay. Okay. So have you had a rub down before? How's that worked for you? It gave me short-term pain relief. Okay. So that makes sense. So you get short-term pain relief from manual stuff. But tell me a bigger story about your goals. Well, you know, if I didn't have this problem, I would be walking in the hills. I'd be doing this. I'd be doing that. I'd be back at work. I'd be playing with the kids. So is that a goal? Is that a goal? Do you think me rubbing you will get you back to that, given your past experience? And I go, nah, it won't. So would you be open to looking at other strategies to get you back to doing the stuff that you really value? Because what I think happens is a lot of people go, what is a physio? It's like, oh, they give us a massage. They put a machine on. That's what they expect. doesn't mean that's what they want. Usually a patient comes in, and we've done some work looking at this, like what do patients want? They want to understand, they want to get living again, and they want a way of doing it. To me, it's like taking a car to a mechanic and it's blowing smoke, and you go, I don't want it to blow smoke. Now, I'm not going to tell the mechanic, I need you to replace my engine. I'm just going to say, I want you to tell me why it's blowing smoke, because I'm worried it's going to blow my engine. And then I have to trust the mechanic to work out what is going on and to tell me a solution so it doesn't blow smoke, or to reassure me the smoke is normal. I just hadn't noticed it before. So I think we get mixed up between what a patient expects and what their real goals and concerns are, and we get too fixated on their expectations and not as much interested to their concerns and their goals and their values. Because when we start orientated our care to that, I think a lot of these roadblocks start to dissipate.
I think you use the right word, the trust between the patient and obviously the physiotherapist. And you know, with your long experience, do you have any advice for clinicians on how to build this trust and this relationship with
patients? Shut up, listen, that's it. Like, just listen. Like, honestly, I get to do a lot of examining of people as well. And too often it's the therapist's agenda. It's not the patient's agenda. It's just listen. Like, listen to them, listen deeply to what your patient's concerns are and ask them and be interested and care for them. If you genuinely care for your patients, they can tell. If the patient feels like that you're ticking boxes or rushing them through a treatment that you've given to everybody else, they can tell. It's a bit like if you meet someone for the first time, how do you know you can trust them or not? If they're doing this on their phone, you know, and they're looking away and they're fidgeting around, they don't give you eye contact and they don't mirror you because they're too interested in something else, you will not trust them with information. You won't. Mm-hmm. But if that person engages with you and asks you about your life and you're genuinely interested and reflects it back to you and validates you, you can be drawn into a trusting relationship very quickly.
And then do you take notes while you chat with the patients for the first time? Or
Yep. So we have I have a computer notes, and I think we can use notes for really well to signal the most important things the person's telling us. So if they're telling us something really important, then I'm typing that into my notes. So I've got my patient literally sitting here with my computer here. So I'm always orientating towards the person, not over a desk. It's like right next to me. And if they're telling me something really important, I am not typing. I'm directly with them, looking at them.
Okay. Yeah, perfect. And then just want to ask a last question. And that's for me working in sport, very interesting for me. Sometimes when we talk about obviously being active and change of lifestyle, especially for low back pain, it's kind of intuitive and easy to say to someone who's got a sedentary job, a 9-to-5 job, and they don't exercise a lot. But then when we actually refer to very active people or professional athletes or even like recreational, but very active people, then it seems a little bit more complicated to prescribe exercise to this population. So I just want to hear from you on this particular topic.
Well, if you use the example of weight loss, right? We talk a lot about weight loss, right? But there's a group of our population who need weight gain, who've got eating disorders. So everything is like a bell-shaped curve. Everything. Human behavior is never in one direction. It's always two-directional. So you've got athletes who don't rest, who flog themselves, who are perfectionists, who drive themselves to exhaustion, who develop chronic fatigue, who exercise too much. That is not healthy. And that's a bit like telling at a population level, saying, you know what, you need to be more active. Well, you wouldn't tell a kid with an eating disorder to be more active. You'd say you need to be less active. So it's really important when we start examining or working with athletes to look at what might be driving. They come to us with pain, and I see a number of athletes as well with persistent pain. And we know that athletes, there are different responses to pain. So some people avoid pain or avoid the activity that causes pain. Others just carry on and ignore it. Now, if you're an athlete and you just carry on ignoring your pain, it may end up with a stress fracture. And we know this when you've got a sudden increase in training, or you've got a very high levels of training volume, and there's insufficient rest or sleep, or there's other stresses in that person's life, then you could be at risk of a stress fracture. So that's like an overstress, right? So there's a sweet spot of stress. So of course it makes no sense to tell a marathon runner or an ultra marathon runner to run more. That's ridiculous. It may be they need to run less, and maybe they need to care for their sleep, and maybe that they need to reorientate their training so that it's less obsessive and less less excessive. It may be that they need to rebalance that, and that's evidence-based.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for your answer. And I think that was the last question for today, Peter. Thanks again for being with us. And just the last thing, obviously, for people to be always updated on your work, what are the best channels on social medias to follow you?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn and on Twitter. I'm sort of on Facebook, but not that much, because I just don't have time. Facebook is too long. People write pages of stuff. I do not have time for that. If I'm writing pages of stuff, it's for a journal article. It's not to reply to someone on a chat room. So Twitter's probably that's the space where we post information. We also run a podcast. I don't know if you've heard of it, called Empowered Beyond Pain. And I'll send you some links to that as well. And that's something that we're doing to bring on world experts to talk about pain, but also patients to talk about their pain experiences and their pain journeys. And that's been really wonderful, actually, because a lot of patients have contacted us from all around the world saying, thank you so much for that podcast. That has changed my life. It's changed the way I think. It's given me new hope. So that's what we try to do around translating our research to do that. The other thing is we have a website called Body Logic Physiotherapy, and we post information up on there as well. We have some great resources for patients. And then there's Pain Health, which is a website which is run by our health department, which also has some really good information. So I can give you a list of links to that.
Great.
Normally, I run a workshop in London once a year, well, a symposium, really. And obviously, I can't travel because of COVID. So we're doing our first web-based training of this kind of approach in June. I can send you the link to that as well.
Oh, yeah.
And within that, we're actually taking real patients and filming their journey. So these are all people who have got disabling pain and are distressed, to look at how you can take someone like that on a journey to change. So these are people I've never met before who've been referred, who have done it like I would in a consult. Because a lot of people hear stuff, they read stuff, but they don't know what it looks like. And I think what it looks like is the key.
Yeah. Wow. Great. And have you got any projects lined up at the moment? Anything to expect from you?
Project. So we've got a large clinical trial that we've been running, testing this approach against usual care in Australia. We've got about 500 people with disabling back pain who are part of that trial. And that's a really important trial for us. We'll be looking at how people respond to this model of care compared to usual care. And we'll also be looking at things like whether they can learn to self-manage their pain, which we know the guidelines talk about, but very little evidence that people can do it. And we're also interested around the cost to the health system, because we know back pain is one of the most expensive disorders of health disorders, costs a ridiculous amount of money. And what we're offering is pretty cheap. So we're interested in comparing, you know, lots of treatment versus lots of treatment that leads people not very far versus an approach to teach people to self-manage. So
wow. Yeah,
we'll have that. And the other thing around that is we're exploring how easy it is to train physiotherapists to deliver this intervention. So we've got a whole body of research around that as well.
Oh, wow.
And what patients think about it. So we're also interviewing the patients to go, what was it like? You know, what was your expectation of physiotherapy and what do you get? Because it's a bit like walking into a shop expecting chocolates and walking out with apples. You know, it's like, what the, how did that work? That I didn't get what I expected, but actually the apple's heaps better than what I thought.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. Yeah. We look forward to. Yeah, reading your next projects. Thanks again, Peter. Thanks for being with us. And I'm sure everyone enjoyed this episode, and we'll obviously see you soon. Thanks again. Bye. Okay.